I really felt like I'd been hit by some special dirt or something. And that's just kind of the feeling I have about the place.
From Wyoming Public Media, this is The Modern West. I'm Micah Schweitzer. From ranches to rigs, this podcast tells stories of the West as it is. In July, Cheyenne, Wyoming held its annual Frontier Days celebration. It's a 10-day rodeo and cowboy culture blowout called the Daddy of Them All. The event draws over 250,000 people to Wyoming's capital, which usually has a population of just 60,000. People come from all around the country and even across the world for this rodeo. So on this month's episode, we're going to dive into Frontier Days and uncover how it keeps the images and traditions of the Old West alive and kicking. Later on, we'll also hear about the surprising journey of one of the many musical performers at Frontier Days. Now, last time on the show, we heard about bull riding sensation Sage Kimsey, and he makes an appearance in this next story as well. The bull rider gets all the fame, but the guy on the bull isn't the only one risking his life. Bull riding is arguably one of the most dangerous sports, and bull fighters are essential to keep the riders safe. They're the unspoken heroes of rodeo. The rodeo clowns forego the glamour of riding to protect the riders. And Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck spoke with two of the bullfighters at Cheyenne Frontier Days.
You just heard what it sounds like inside the chute during the bull riding event at Cheyenne Frontier Days. But you might not have been able to make out the rodeo announcer thanking bullfighter Daryl Diefenbach for knocking a bull away from a helpless bull rider who had fallen to the ground. It's something Diefenbach and his Frontier Days partner Dusty Tuckness are prepared to do every day. They are veteran bullfighters chosen to work Frontier Days because they are among the best in the world. Part of that is their attitude. Diefenbach had a couple of physical battles with bulls in the last few days, and it's part of the job he's been doing for 25 years, since he first got involved in rodeo in Queensland, Australia.
You fight bulls long enough, get in front of enough bulls, you're going to get run over. And if you're not prepared to get run over, then you're in the wrong profession.
Dusty Tuckness has been doing this since he was 12 years old in Meteetse, Wyoming. He loves what he does and never worries.
You can't panic, you can't get out there and get scared and worried and stuff. I mean, you know, me and Daryl, we're out there, we're calm. You know, our main objective is to save that bull rider at hand, and then after that, when we fall through and roll through, you know, we're going to pick the bulls off each other and get everybody out in good shape. You know, a lot of times it works out good, sometimes we got to take some shots, but again, that's just part of the job.
And there is a strategy to making sure the bull rider doesn't get gored or trampled. It involves anticipating where the rider is going to land.
When that gate opens, you know, we're watching the bull, watching the cowboy, back and forth. And so 9 times out of 10, we can kind of have it in a 6-foot ballpark where that guy's going to hit the ground. And so we want to be able to position ourselves into a spot when he does hit the ground that we can squeeze through there and direct that bull away.
Under the arena where the bull riders hang out, bullfighters are much appreciated. Sage Kimsey is the top money earner this year, and he says bullfighters keep him healthy so that he can compete.
Without them, you know, we'd be banged up even more than we already are, and it's a long road even with them. I would hate to even imagine my job without the bullfighters.
A couple of days ago, Diefenbach and Tuckness got between a very mean bull and rider Artie Meyer. For a moment, Meyer thought the bull was going to hurt him.
He had the option to line me out, and they went in there, and we all got out of there clean, and it was a good example of what them guys do and how much you appreciate what they do.
Do you buy drinks when you see them later?
No, I'll buy them a beer once in a while, I suppose, but I don't have to buy them a beer for them to step in there and save me, so it's a pretty cool deal.
But he probably should for one simple fact. While the bull riders may get fewer injuries, the bullfighters get plenty. Diefenbach has probably put some insurance companies out of business.
Broke my neck, broke my back twice, had to have a shoulder reconstructed, knee surgeries. This is my third eye socket in my right eye, ribs.
Tuckness says injuries, though, are just part of the job. He says you get patched up, rehab, and come back for more. Bullfighting might not be as glamorous as bull riding, but it is absolutely vital to keep the show going. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Bull riders and bronc riders get most of the glory at a rodeo, so most rodeo stars are men. But there is one age-old rodeo event that was developed especially for women, barrel racing. It's been around since the early 1900s, but it's not for wimps. Racers on horseback make loops as fast and as tight as they can around three barrels set up in a triangle before heading back to the start, and they do it all in under 18 seconds. One of the fastest barrel racers in the world is 19-year-old Cassidy Cruz from Gillette, Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spent a day with her.
They call this race a cinch shootout. It's invitation only, and it's Cassidy Cruz's first time.
We all run one run, and then I guess the top four come back for a second run, and then us top four run for $10,000.
Sounds like big money, right? But Cruz has won bigger. In fact, just last weekend in Casper.
I won about $12,500 just last weekend in three runs.
But Cruz doesn't just race in Wyoming. This year, she's raced in 36 rodeos and placed in 28.
Oh, I've been all over from Mississippi to California.
At 19 years old, she's making a living as a rodeo star.
My fastest time I've ever ran on a standard pattern is a 16.8. And that
16 seconds?
16.8, yep.
Wow.
So, and that is like very, very fast.
But Cassidy gives all the credit for that speed to her horse, JJ.
I like him to have like an attitude. My horse does. He has an attitude and he thinks he's the boss of everything, but we also treat him like he's a king, so.
But all that horsey attitude also makes barrel racing pretty dangerous.
I've had my front teeth knocked out before. JJ reared up and hit me in the face and broke my tooth and gave me a black eye.
But JJ isn't here today for the cinch shootout. He's still back in Naples, Idaho, where Cruz raced in another rodeo last night. Today, Cruz is doing something she rarely does. She's borrowing a horse named Ellie from her friend Pamela Nelson. Fact is, things didn't go so well for JJ last night in Idaho. Cruz and her mother, Pam, tell Nelson the whole story.
You probably already know, Nampa went absolutely terrible.
Really?
I got a no time.
What happened?
I just didn't cue him for his turn and he didn't take it. We like hit the fence and then like he literally like we stopped.
Yikes.
After it happened, Cruz even called her mom and said she wasn't coming to Cheyenne.
I'm like, oh yes you are, I booked airplanes,
Pam told her to cowgirl up, but right now, that means getting on a strange horse to race in an unknown event. And it starts in only 15 minutes.
Okay, Cass, get your mind cleared out. Be ready, rock star. Don't coast into that barrel. Take her. Okay, I'm done. That's all the lectures you're getting.
Yep, send her. She'll get really nervous when you put your rubber bands on. So.
And you, spurs are good?
Yep, spurs are fine.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Go get him.
Thank you.
Cruz's mom, Pam, and I head to the stands to watch.
Excuse me, honey.
Pam says she feels sick to her stomach. She's worried that the flop in Idaho will shake her daughter's confidence today. But she says her daughter has shown she has what it takes to deal with the extreme highs and lows of this career.
Her dad was a team roper and a bull rider, and she started actually riding horses by herself when she was about three.
After the men's events, it's barrel racing time. Cruz is up first.
Hey, Gillette, Wyoming cowgirl! Somebody help her down the home stretch! And a
17.2 seconds. It's over before I know it. In fact, in a flash of flying hair and horsetails, all eight women race and the whole thing is over. Only one woman beats Cruz's time, but only by 0.13 seconds.
17.07!
I'm still happy.
Yes.
Smoked.
Cruz is still in the running for the $10,000. Her mom wipes away tears of relief and we hurry back to meet her daughter between races.
How did it feel? What did you think?
It's pretty cool. It was exciting. Like, it was exciting. Well, I'm not going to lie. I knew she was going to turn, but you think third's like in the middle of nowhere. So I grabbed her, and as soon as I grabbed her, and so I did have to like pull her back out. I was like, God dang it, she told me not to do that.
So you mentioned earlier that you wanted a horse with attitude. Did she feel like she...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's definitely the right one, then.
Oh, yeah. She has attitude, that's for sure. Yeah.
But there's no time to relax and enjoy the moment or wonder how it would have been different on her own horse, JJ. The final Cinch Shootout race starts in just a few minutes. And tomorrow, it's on to Salt Lake City. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Okay, let's take a step back from Cheyenne Frontier Days. Gender roles in rodeo is one area of study for Dr. Renee Legrade. Legrade teaches history of the American West at the University of Wyoming, and she's also a longtime rodeo fan.
I love going to rodeos. I really do. And, you know, as my husband says, you're the only person at the rodeo taking notes. So,
So I reached Legrade on vacation in her home state of Alaska to talk about rodeo's history.
And so it began really as private amusement for the cattle hands. They would bet against one another who could ride the fastest or who had the fastest horse and who could stay on bucking bronc the longest.
And what sort of a role did rodeos play in the Old West? I've read that they actually were not of much significance in Wyoming in the 1800s until later in the century.
Yeah, so... You know, cattle industry began with the Spanish introducing cattle during the 1600s. And so most of the cattle industry was focused down in the south. So you have this really interesting mix of Mexican and black and some Anglos down, some French, all kind of in the borderlands region, working cattle. And then it slowly moved north when the U.S. gained territory after the U.S.-Mexico Wars. And then with the railroad and westward expansion and then Civil War, all these things conspired to help create a demand for beef. And so the cattle industry really started to grow. But yeah, in Wyoming, it wasn't a big deal until 1868 or so. So it's really interesting. If you look at a chronology of the cattle industry, you see rodeo as a spectator sport emerging after the cattle drives and after the cattle era, really, that we think of when you see the John Wayne movies and everything. So cattle drives ended, late 1880s, mostly because the railroad lines had been expanded to the point where you didn't have to drive cattle to a railhead anymore. The lines came down to the places where cattle were being raised. And it's about that time that you see the first spectator rodeos. So, the private getting together of all the cowhands, and competing against one another evolved from private into the realm of spectator sport. Prescott, Arizona was the first one that had a spectator event where people had to actually pay to go see a rodeo. And so it's not that much longer. It's less than 10 years later that Cheyenne Frontier Days has its first rodeo.
So if cattle drives had already ended by the time spectator rodeos became something, were they from the very beginning in the business of in some way recreating the legends and the myths and the romance of the Old West?
A lot of rodeos and a lot of frontier activities started around the time that the American population realized that the frontier era had come to a close. When that ends, the myth begins.
And so 100-odd years later, what's the meaning of rodeos today?
It's really interesting because in a way it's tapping into the nostalgia for our past. I think, Americans in general look at the cowboy and the frontier West as a really unique part of our national history. And going to see the rodeos and the cowboys is a way of connecting with that. What I think is really interesting is at the first Prescott, Arizona rodeo, 1888, The guy that walked away with a prize for all-around cowboy wasn't a cowboy at all. I mean, wasn't a cattleman, really. He was a guy, a pipe fitter, who had moved west to kind of find the American, you know, the westward dream, and ended up being a cowboy. Anyone can be a cowboy, as kind of the myth goes, if you have the right attitude.
And, of course, so, you're talking about cowboys. What about gender roles in rodeos? I mean, it is a very male event in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It took women a long time to be able to compete. You know, there's great history of rodeo women, women who, because they were really skilled and really good at what they could do, riding broncs or roping, even a couple did bulldogging, they were able to, you know, make a stand and become accepted. But, you know, when you look at the professional rodeo events, women are only allowed to compete in barrel racing for the PCRA events or rodeos.
And that's the Professional Rodeo Association.
Right. Women are becoming more accepted in things like team roping, but still there's a lot of prejudice against women becoming as competing against men. So if you really want to see some really top-notch women riding in all the events, you go to the women's rodeos.
And what about people of color? Because as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that was how rodeos originated, with black cowboys, of course, with the Mexican cowboys, and then slowly moved north. Now it seems to be much whiter.
A lot of that has to do with racial attitudes. You know, there are always a couple of exceptional Native American riders. Bill Pickett, you know, an amazing rider in the early 1900s. But what you see happening in the 1970s is rodeo splintering off. So there's all black rodeo and all Native American rodeo, where people of color feel more comfortable competing amongst themselves rather than having to deal with the prejudice that they often encounter in like you say, the white rodeo.
Is that also a function of how we view history in terms of who won the West?
Yeah, the West has been pretty well whitewashed. You know, and when you talk about all-American rodeo, like you were alluding to, people think of white people on horses, mostly guys and maybe a few women. But it was very diverse. You know, you think about it, especially in the borderlands where rodeo emerged, a lot of Hispanics, you know, a lot of blacks. You had French people, Creoles. But when the history of the West was written, they were left out of it.
Renee Legrade is a professor of history of the American West at the University of Wyoming. She joined us on the phone from the library in Anchorage, Alaska, where she's on vacation. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk about this and pull back the curtain on rodeo's history.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And there's another group of people who feel left out of the classic Western image. For many gay and lesbian people, the rodeo tradition is one of intolerance and exclusion. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank has that story.
Ryan Reed loves rodeo, and each July, he makes a pilgrimage here to the so-called Daddy of Them All in Cheyenne.
You just feel like you're on hollow ground when you're here.
Roaming the Frontier Days Midway, this amateur steer wrestler and calf roper is like a kid in a candy store.
Yesterday, during the bareback bronc, I actually got some dirt flung on me, and I really felt like I'd been hit by some special dirt or something. And that's just kind of the feeling I have about the place.
Reed sports a cowboy hat and handlebar mustache. He looks like he belongs at the rodeo, but he hasn't always felt that way, even though the sport was part of his childhood.
I was around it, but to some degree felt probably excluded from it. As a young, gay, closeted kid on the farm, you can kind of be afraid of your own shadow. And so I think I probably just felt like maybe it wasn't for me.
Reed works with the International Gay Rodeo Association. It's an amateur rodeo circuit with 20 local chapters that puts on about a dozen rodeos every year. Anyone can compete, but these rodeos are meant to be places where gay and lesbian cowboys and cowgirls who haven't felt welcome at traditional rodeos can be themselves.
Being openly gay and being involved in traditional rodeo, these two things clash and are unworkable. There is a whole lifestyle and set of traditions around rodeo. It's probably one of the things we all love about it. But for some folks, part of that tradition is exclusionary of gays and lesbians and trans people.
At Frontier Days, Reed says this can be subtle. Take the kiss cam, for example, something you see at a lot of pro sports events.
And of course, it's always a man and woman. And if they go for two men, it's a joke. Ha ha, isn't that funny? Two guys, ha ha. Putting forth the notion that the only people here are straight people. And I know that's not the case. My partner and I are here together today. So probably be a little while before my partner and I end up on the kiss cam. But I did tell him today, hey, if they do it, I'm kissing you.
The thing is, gay men and women are a part of this traditional rodeo culture, just not always openly. Like a man I'll call Wayne, who's been volunteering behind the scenes at Cheyenne Frontier Days for decades.
Well, Frontier Days and rodeo are an old traditional family values type of an event.
The reason I'm calling him Wayne instead of using his real name, and the reason he sounds like someone demanding a ransom instead of how he really sounds, is because working the rodeo means a lot to him, and he's afraid that if everybody here learns he's gay, he might not be able to do it anymore.
I don't know what the implications would be, but, you know, they could take me off the committee, or they could assign me no duties, or whatever. I don't know. It's up in the air.
Wayne grew up in the cowboy state and has always been a rodeo fan, but because of the so-called traditional family values he feels are such a part of this world, Wayne hides his own family life from some fellow volunteers.
Like I said, you know, some people know, some don't. So I just don't broadcast.
Wayne says there are many gay people involved in rodeo in one way or another, but as long as the culture remains exclusive, it's a missed opportunity.
Not only do you have the participants and the producers and whatever, but there are a lot of fans out there, and a lot of them are gay.
It was only through the gay rodeo circuit that Ryan Reed was able to get into the sport. Today, he's visiting a statue of Lane Frost on the rodeo grounds, paying respects to the legendary bull rider who died here in Cheyenne in 1989.
What I love about this is you can see it moving. The statue, I mean, is just so well done. The artist that sets the sculpture did such an amazing job. You think it's gonna move right in front of your eyes. We just think of Lane Frost as someone who loved rodeo as much or more than anybody else, and he gave it his all.
There are no openly gay competitors in pro rodeo, but Reed points out that's the reality for most sports, thanks to stereotypes about the athletic ability of gay men and concerns about fan backlash. The tide is shifting, though. Teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers are hosting LGBT nights, but that's LA and baseball. This is Wyoming and rodeo. Reed's not holding his breath.
Would I love it if traditional rodeo became more open to LGBT people like other pro sports have? Yes, I would love to see that. Do they think we're going to do that? No, probably not, except for the fact that maybe we'll change people's minds about whether gay people can rodeo or not. It turns out we can.
Gay rodeos across the country show that all sorts of people are drawn to the cowboy tradition. But if exclusion is the norm in mainstream rodeo culture, perhaps that's one tradition that's worth bucking. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
Now, in that piece, we heard from Ryan Reed, who works for the International Gay Rodeo Association. The IGRA's 20 local chapters put on about a dozen gay-friendly rodeos every year. Both gay and straight people are welcome at these events as fans and competitors. Reed himself competes. And Aaron Schrank continued his conversation with Reed about what the organization and the sport mean to him.
My name is Ryan Reed. I'm the public relations director for the International Gay Rodeo Association.
Tell me how you first came to it, how you first got involved.
You know, I had just moved to Sacramento, California for graduate school, and I happened upon a fundraiser barbecue for the local Gay Rodeo Association. And they just seemed like really nice folks. I grew up on a farm, and it was really interesting to run across other folks, a lot of whom had the same kind of growing up background, and also still had an interest in sort of ranch and farm life. And they invited me to a rodeo, and I went. and think that was probably in October, and by February, I was signed up to compete.
What events do you compete in?
I do shoot-doggin', which is a steer wrestling event, similar to bulldoggin', but we come out of a chute, not off of a horse, to do the dog. Also do some calf roping. And then we have a set of events that are somewhat special to Gay Rodeo. We call them camp events. We have one called Steer Deco, which is a team event. It's actually steer decorating. The idea is for a two-person team to get a ribbon tied to the tail of a steer that probably isn't that interested in having that done. Yeah. We've got goat dressing that I do sometimes. Audience favorite. Basically, two-person team's got to get undies on a goat. And we've also got wild drag, which is a three-person team. You've got to get somebody that's dressed in a wig and a dress. It could be a man or a woman. You got to get them on the back of a steer.
That sounds, in some ways, I don't have much experience with rodeo, but that sounds more fun than mainstream rodeo, perhaps.
Well, I have been thrilled when I often do hear people, both gay and straight, when they come to one of our rodeos and they'll tell me, hey, this was more fun than I expected, or maybe this was more fun than other rodeos I had been to. So I do like hearing that.
So did you, when you first got into rodeo in this way, had you had past experience with rodeo? I mean, obviously, I know you mentioned growing up on a farm, but with rodeo competition specifically?
I had not competed, but I certainly grew up knowing people in rodeo. One of my brother's best friends was a team roper, actually lost a thumb doing it. there was always a rodeo at the county fair. So I was around it, but to some degree felt probably excluded from it. As a young, gay, closeted kid on the farm, you can kind of be afraid of your own shadow. It's one of the things you have to work through as you become an adult. And so I think I just felt like maybe it wasn't for me, even though I thought it was cool. And obviously, once I had the opportunity and felt welcomed, I was in. I was all in.
Tell me, you know, why this organization and why these events are needed. Are mainstream rodeos welcoming to gays and lesbians?
I'll first say that we serve a purpose in terms of giving folks a place to go who may not feel like, say, urban gay culture or urban gay organizations really speak to them or to their experiences. That's not to say that we don't have city folks who've decided they like rodeo and they want to be involved, and that's great. We run rodeo schools and we'll teach you how. But it serves a purpose for creating a place for people who otherwise don't have a place. So there's that. We know from our members' experiences that being openly gay and being involved in traditional rodeo, these two things clash and are unworkable. There is a whole lifestyle and set of traditions around rodeo. It's probably one of the things we all love about it. But for some folks, part of that tradition is exclusionary of gays and lesbians and trans people. We don't think that's the case, and we think that we're a good example of the fact that that isn't the case, that we can have rodeos and we can celebrate Western culture and Western traditions and still be inclusive.
And, you know, you mentioned in your own case being somebody that perhaps had difficulty reconciling your gay identity with that of, you know, being a farm boy or,
sure,
or whatever it is.
Sure.
Do you find that that's a common experience?
Absolutely. If you can't see a role model that looks anything like you, it's kind of hard to see your future. But if you can look around and go, oh, there are people that are like me, they're living happy, successful lives, no matter who you are, where you come from, that's a really helpful thing. So I think we represent that. And you can go through and talk to IJRA members and you will find these stories sort of repeated with their own special nuances, but the same sort of pattern.
And not to go too deep into your own, you know, your own experience necessarily, but I'm curious in your own case when you came out as gay.
When I was a senior in college, so took a few years, but yeah, my senior year of college, living in Los Angeles at the time.
Did you come out to your family at that time as well?
I rolled it out slowly. Sister was first. My sister and my mom are best friends. So I told my sister first so that my mom would have somebody to talk to when I told her. Mom really didn't want me to tell Dad. She didn't think he could handle it. She said, you know, he's a farmer. He's not very worldly. But I pushed and pushed. And once she agreed to let me tell him, I told him. It certainly took some adjustment for them. It's been quite a long time now, though. And I think they've all gotten to a place of comfort that they probably didn't expect to get to. But I will say one of the most sort of, I guess you use the word reconciling, one of the most reconciling moments I ever had was when my parents came to one of my rodeos. It was an opportunity for my dad has always had horses, loves horses. And so for him to get to see a rodeo and me be involved with it and see gay folks competing, I think for him made it all a little easier to accept. And it was wonderful for me. It felt like something clicked, especially with my dad at that point.
I guess in terms of the function of the organization, is it looking to form a kind of thriving subculture or looking to change traditional rodeo at all?
I don't think we're trying to change traditional rodeo. I think that our purpose is to be inclusive, to bring together people who love rodeo, to do this fundraising for our charity partners around the country. You know, would I love it if traditional rodeo became more open to LGBT people like other pro sports have? Yes, I would love to see that. Do they think we're going to do that? No, probably not, except for the fact that maybe we'll change people's minds about whether gay people can rodeo or not. It turns out we can. In fact, gay people are rodeoing in traditional rodeo, but they're not going to be open about who they are, especially if in traditional rodeo they're trying to make a career out of it. That would kill their career, and they know that. And it would just make rodeo probably really unenjoyable for them. And they probably love rodeo, and they want it to be enjoyable.
You mentioned that other professional sports are perhaps becoming more inclusive. I mean, still, when you look at the big ones in America, you know, football, basketball, baseball, only very recently have we even had openly gay athletes.
Sure.
Why isn't there that acceptance and understanding of it?
So two things. In sports generally, I think there's still a stereotype at play, particularly for gay men, that they can't play sports, that they are too weak, not aggressive enough, not skilled enough, whatever it is. So I think that's at play across pro sports. I think there's also concerns about just what the audience might think about having an openly gay player. I think the NBA has actually handled it better and are sort of doing well. The Michael Sam case in the NFL is not such a good case, right? On the other hand, you have Major League Baseball teams who have gay night during each season or something. So they're certainly trying and their audiences don't seem to be rejecting it. And I think that brings us to the PRCA and the rest of traditional rodeo, where there's probably a concern that the audience has expectations that are coming from a more conservative place, and they don't want, perhaps, to watch a gay athlete compete. We don't know that. This assumption has never been tested, but I would say that that's the assumption, and you need an audience. You have sponsors. This is a business. You need to keep it going, and you can't have your audience rejecting your sport over what might just be one athlete, you might think, right? When you've got all these other athletes that are dependent on the sport.
Is there ever negative reaction to the gay rodeo events from towns or, you know, from wherever you're at?
You know, that's another place where we've seen progress. So in the 1980s and the 1990s, it was so common for us to have negative reactions that we even have a set of sort of rules that are all about how to keep bad things from happening the night before a rodeo. For example, you have to have some sort of tool that will allow you to cut a chain of a certain gauge, because we've had people show up in the middle of the night and chain our livestock up and padlock them, and we couldn't get the livestock out on Saturday morning to actually have our rodeo. So now you have to have tools on hand in case that happens. We have security guards who have to stay out and watch over the stock overnight at the rodeo and sort of watch over things. But, you know, those are starting to feel like legacy rules, because we haven't had incidents like that in recent memory. I think that's a sign of progress as well. But we find now that cities actually are sort of vying to have us bring the rodeo to town. You know, that's about dollar signs, certainly, but it's also about acceptance. Because there was certainly a point where not for any amount of money did anyone want our rodeo in their town, right? And so we've at least gotten to the point where we're in the market now, and we weren't before.
Cowboys in Wranglers, bucking Broncos, and raging bulls in a dirt arena may be the images that come to mind when you think about rodeo. But two of Cheyenne Frontier Day's most recognizable faces are known just as much for their outfits as they are for their riding. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard spoke with this year's Miss Frontier and her lady-in-waiting about what it takes to act royally in the dirt and dust of rodeo.
Cheyenne Frontier Days is run almost exclusively by volunteers. Most wear jeans, cowboy boots, and hats, and they blend in with many of the visitors. But there are two you can't miss. They wear giant white leather buckskin outfits with fringe, hats with a beaded tiara, and of course, a sash. They're this year's Miss Frontier.
My name is Sarah Rangich.
And her lady-in-waiting.
My name is Jonna Brown.
As Rangich says, they're kind of the face of the event.
We basically serve as the Goodwill Ambassadors for Frontier Days, so we travel all year to events throughout Cheyenne and other rodeos and everything like that, school visits, that kind of thing, to promote Frontier Days. And then once Frontier Days is actually here, our job is to just welcome people, just kind of be a friendly face.
And as I understand it, lady-in-waiting, you're sort of learning the ropes, yep, to use a rodeo pun.
Yep. Yeah, as my job as lady-in-waiting is to kind of follow Sarah around, learn everything I can this year, and then in August, after Frontier Days is over, I'll take over as Miss Frontier, and then they'll hold a new lady-in-waiting selection tryout.
For all that, they even get their own parking spaces.
So yeah, we both get to park our trucks here, which this is, believe me, it's helpful. It doesn't seem like it right now, but parking here gets crazy, so.
Next door, Rangich and Brown have set up camp in an RV by the stables.
Welcome to our home.
This is my grandparents' fifth wheel, so they live in this for 5 years of the year, or 5 months of the year, sorry. Words are getting tied. So we have, all my outfits are right there. I don't know if you can tell. It's about 20 shirts and pants probably back there. So we change for all the concerts and everything. I don't even think I have all of my clothes out here yet, if you could believe it. So we have quite a few.
A lot of outfits can mean a lot of time, especially if you're wearing the traditional leather buckskin outfit. It's huge, with multiple layers of shirts, pants, vests, and boots. I asked Jonna Brown how long it takes her to get ready.
Well, I'm really slow, so I take, I don't know, probably 2 hours. Just putting this outfit on takes a good 10, 15 minutes. One time we actually had to rush putting it on at a rodeo, and it was very, it's hard getting all
it
of this.
Really hot, and it's just like, oh my gosh.
The first time I actually put it on, I had it on like all wrong, and Sarah's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, it's my first time putting it on, so it's pretty challenging.
Was it always your dream to be Miss Frontier?
Oh, yes. Ever since I saw the first Miss Frontier when I was at my very first rodeo, I looked at my brothers and I said, that's going to be me one day. And my brother, after lady-in-waiting tryouts, he's like, wow, you weren't kidding. So it definitely has been a dream.
What kind of a time commitment is it to be a lady-in-waiting and Miss Frontier?
You know, it is quite the time commitment, especially during the summer. You can't really have a job during the summer because we do travel to rodeos and stuff.
This is your job.
Yes, exactly. Throughout the school year, though, we were both full-time students at the University of Wyoming. I had enough time, hopefully, I passed everything. So, but during the school year, it's actually not terrible. It's mostly stuff on the weekends. You know, it's not terrible it's not terrible ever, but it's not that huge of a time commitment until the summer starts.
Once the summer starts,
early mornings, late nights, the days of the parades we're in every parade. We go to every pancake breakfast. Wednesdays especially a little busy because we have the air show with the USAF Thunderbirds, and it's Cheyenne Day, and it's a huge celebration. We go to all the concerts. That's kind of one of our perks. We get to go to the meet and greets with all the artists, and then go to this viewing area, I suppose, like right up on the stage. They're early mornings and late nights, but they're definitely worth it. So we're out there at everything.
We're also out at the rodeo, obviously. In the grand entry, we'll do our flyby every day. So we get to run out of the middle chute and run down the track full speed on our horses, wave into the crowd. So that's something I'm really looking forward to.
That's not all Jonna is looking forward to. Once she's done this year as lady-in-waiting, she'll start her reign as Miss Frontier in August.
I'm really excited as Miss Frontier to get a new lady-in-waiting that I can start mentoring and hopefully be in charge. So I'm just really looking forward to the 2016 Daddy of them all. Sounds weird saying, but it'll be here before we know it.
For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Caroline Ballard.
Outside the rodeo arena is another group of skilled professionals vying for glory. Carnival games operators leverage years of practice and skill to convince people like you to pay cash for the opportunity to win a plush stuffed prize. For many of them, it's not just a job, it's a way of life. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan spent time with a few of these games operators and has this postcard.
My name is Andre Evans, and I'm a games operator. I work for Terry Charleston Concessions, and this game is one ball. Say, Dad, bring that hero over here and let him win my one. Let me just show it to you.
See, when you win over here, you don't get no Wheaties prize. This is where the big dogs sit. Are you ready?
you see a group of people, who's the alpha? Let's say if I see a mom and a dad and two teenagers. So dad, because of his male ego, he ordinarily, a lot of them don't want to look bad in front of the family. So he'll be more resistant to playing. So what I'll do is I'll ask dad to bring the kids over, let them be a hero and win mom one. Hey, watch it. Watch this dude right here. Here he goes. Oh, he got nervous. See, that's what a pretty girl would make you do. The arm would start going crazy. There's a code that goes with this way of living, the Carney Code. This is something that's come down through the centuries. And it offers an opportunity for people who don't fit in other walks of life. They're a little bit too outgoing. They're more extroverted. They're more adventurous. I have the freedom to be me.
All right, you guys ready? Sound the bell. Here comes your weather, guys. Shoot them. Hey, shoot them up the teeth, the top, guys. Don't miss the drop. Please get a winning. Don't look up, Twitter. That's why you're losing.
We read people. You know, like, I can pick. We can pretty much pick up your personality, and then we'll play on that and use that to have an idea of how to come at you. Craig McPherson, McPherson, and I'm a game operator. I remember being in Cleveland, Ohio. We were busy, it was a Saturday, and this mom comes up, she's probably 2 or 3 years old, this little girl, and she's tugging on my shirt. She says, "Mister, what do I have to do to win that purple unicorn?" And I told her, I said, "Your mom, you gotta make one ball in, 3 for 5, make one." And then she said, "My daughter really needs that purple unicorn." I said, "Ma'am, I'm really busy. What's the deal here?" She said, "She's been diagnosed with a cancer and she's got about 6 months to live." And when she told me that, I stopped. I walked across my game. I pulled that purple unicorn down and gave it to that little girl, and she just started crying. And she looked up and she says, "I love you." And that's what kind of kept me in this business as long as I've been in it. You know what I mean? You want to think about it?
Well, after watching it out.
If you change your mind, come back and talk to me. I'm here all day, so. On a good year, I can make anywhere from $120,000 to $200,000 a year.
Hey, how about it, ladies? Oh, cut it out. Even you can do this one.
Scott Menge. I've been in the amusement industry 49 years. I'm a past president of Showman's Association. Run carnivals in Miami, Chicago, Indiana. Inspected rides in 11 different states. My father started the business in our hometown county fair with a pony ride. It's in 1966. Guy was in a family of 5 children. All of us helped our parents. And there was another family out there that had 8 children. Another family had 7 children. And we all hung out together. Now it's definitely more business orientated. It used to be a family thing, and now it's not so much. Once it's in your blood, I guess it's hard to get out. I've done things. I had a limousine company and supper clubs in the wintertime, but every time summer roll around or spring, you'd get that spring fever and take back off on the road. No matter what I had going on in the winter, I'd always, spring would come around, go back on the road.
Come on, pretty girl. You can do it right here, right now.
Oh! Oh! Thank you.
Hey, I can see you on TV somewhere doing something. I don't have to toe the corporate line. I don't have to look a certain way. You don't have the 9-to-5 lifestyle. You don't have the corporate masters. You don't have the supervisor standing over your head. This is the last frontier. It's freedom out here.
Of course, the very name Frontier Days is meant to conjure up images of the Old West. And that includes Native Americans, who have been part of Cheyenne Frontier Days pretty much from the beginning.
Calling all dancers, calling all dancers.
These are the North Bear Singers and Little Sun Drum and Dance Group from the Wind River Indian Reservation. At the center of the Indian village is an arena for the drum and the dancers. It's ringed by vendors selling traditional and not-so-traditional crafts. Beadworker Jim Howlingwolf says visitors want to see traditional items like baskets and rugs, but that's not necessarily what sells best.
The
beadwork is still traditional in the way it's done, but the items that I'm beading are more non-traditional. Ninja Turtles, Hello Kitties.
You can see that balance between old and new in the dance circle, too. The dancers wear feathers and moccasins. The drum players and singers are wearing ball caps and sneakers.
My Indian name is Sinan Cedar. I am a member of the Northern Arapaho people. And my name is Sandra Ironcloud. And we are happy to be here to share with you, give you some cultural insight as to our everyday lives and also as what we do as powwow people.
It's a nuance some visitors don't get right away, says Shorty Loudermilk. He's been volunteering at the Indian Village for 35 years, and he says some people think Indians are stuck in the 1800s.
Honestly, we actually have people that ask, you know, do they live here all the time? And in the teepees, it's like, no, they have jobs just like the rest of us do.
Sandra Ironcloud says she's had a great time at Frontier Days, but she's also experienced some stereotyping.
You know, you see it a little bit sometimes. Like one time we went to the rodeo grounds and they started, you know, war whooping at us and started saying some started cussing at us, you know, but they were drunk cowboys. What do you expect? You know, see, that's a stereotype right there too, you know.
Of course, reality is more complicated. Tradition isn't stuck in time. It's more like practices that carry on through time and that can change along the way. For instance, Native American fancy dance, with its quick footwork, took off in the 1950s and 60s in the Southern Plains, which might seem pretty new compared to the 1800s.
There is somewhere between a misunderstanding and a false perception of what Native America really is at this point in history.
Lakota musician Paul LaRouche performed at Frontier Days with his band Brulé.
It's not a bad perception. It's just that it's behind, you know, I would say it's probably 50 to 60 years behind where our culture really is today.
LaRouche offers a modern American Indian experience with his music by mixing native drums with synthesizers and electric guitars. And what's now traditional was itself once new, like Sandra Ironcloud's calico dress.
Which is symbolic of the trading days, the late 1800s, you know, when the buffalo, you know, when we were put on reservations.
But a lot of people, because we're in Wyoming, thinks that the Indians and cowboys are still fighting here, and we're not, you know, so, but it's funny.
Volunteer Shorty Loudermilk points out two of the dances quickly dispelled that idea. An honor dance for one of the Cheyenne Frontier Days committees had cowboy hats mingling with feathers in the dance circle. And at the end, the entire audience was invited to join in.
Come join us. This is our friendship dance. This is how we come together as people. We come together as relations, as friends, as family. There we go, ladies and gentlemen. Move them feet. Feel the music. Uh-huh. Looking good. Loving all them smiles. Here we go.
John Fernandez was visiting Frontier Days from New Hampshire and joined in the friendship dance.
Part of what makes America America is that we all live together and we can basically harmoniously carry out these traditions and have respect for each other.
And that's a very new idea. So in that story, we heard briefly from one of the many musical acts at Frontier Days. Paul LaRouche leads the award-winning Native American group Brulé. He's a member of the Lower Brule or Brulé Sioux tribe, and he says the band's mission is cultural reconciliation. Brulé's music and mission of cultural reconciliation comes from Paul's own surprising life story. He grew up in a white middle-class family in rural Minnesota, and until his late 30s, he thought he was white. But in 1987, that changed.
It was that year that I lost both of my adoptive parents. And keep in mind, I never referred to my parents as adoptive parents until years later after all this had transpired. But I lost them both in the same year, and of course that led to a search on my wife's part, unbeknownst to me. She had discovered some of my adoption papers while going through my parents' belongings, and she began that search. And so it was the better share of 5 years that she worked on that, and it eventually led to a phone call with my biological brother. Neither of us had known the other had existed all those years, so you can kind of imagine what that conversation was like.
Well, tell me, what was it? What did you say? What did he say?
Well, his first words to me, I remember very, very clearly, they were, he just said, "Hey, bro, did you know that you are a Lakota?" And I didn't know that. I mean, and so that was a revelation in itself. And from there, the conversation went on. I mean, we essentially exchanged our life stories in the matter of 2 or 3 hours. And the closest thing I can compare it to, I've done a lot of reading over the years, and I've kind of held on to the term paradigm shift, and we've all heard of that. But I think that's probably what happened in my case. It simply was a matter of most everything that I had been taught, everything I had been programmed to believe about the Native American culture. I had to somehow put myself on the other side of the fence. And embrace both sides of this thing, because it became clear to me now that I was a part of both of these worlds. And so, you know, very emotional.
So did you identify as white?
I did, 100%.
And now?
Now I would say that I'm clearly right in the middle of this thing. I like to consider myself a product of two worlds and an equal part of both. I guess if I were to put it into numbers, I would say that I am clearly a product of, part of white middle-class America, and I am also an equal amount of Native America within one person.
And those are, of course, such different worlds. You could even say, in some sense, opposing worlds, because of the oppression from the white community on Native Americans. I mean, reservations tend to be poor. They're not middle class. How do you reconcile that?
That's where the real nuts and bolts of our story, I think, really lie. And I talk about this many times from the stage. If you were to suddenly discover that you were part of two cultures that, you know, had been at odds with each other, I mean, we're talking about mainstream America and Native America. But I thought about this many times. You could have been a product of the North and the South, that dilemma. You could have been a product of maybe a Jewish community and a German community. I can go across the globe, and we can all pick examples out. But that's the real thing. When you are part of two cultures that have been in those positions, it really causes you to examine really what's going on and what are we as humans all about. I can't say, I wish I could, I can't say is that I had an affinity for Native America as a young boy. But I certainly remember what I was taught, and I remember what I thought. You know, I thought probably like everybody else that here's a culture that is poor, here's a culture that was conquered, they're a conquered people, here's a culture that struggles from many dysfunctions, and, you know, I just never got a chance to, the history that I was taught as a young boy in that part of the country, I think was fairly accurate, but there was no glorification of the Native American culture, as I recall, you know. So it was a little bit of a struggle for me in the first few minutes of the conversation to come to terms with the fact that that is now who I was.
You know, identity, understanding ourselves, is probably one of the things that most of us grapple with for most of our lives. And in your case, you had everything change in just a moment. What was that like reconstructing your identity? How did you figure out who you were when that happened?
When we concluded that phone conversation, the first time I spoke to my biological brother, the first time two of us talked and we shared our life stories, something very profound happened in that short period of time. As I recall, it was about a 2.5 hour conversation. And it was a conversation that really forever changed my life. But I have come to realize that now, 20 years into the Brule journey, that it continues. It continues to shape and mold as every year goes by, as every day goes by. And so I don't think the process will ever end. As human beings, I think we need time to mature, especially spiritually. And, you know, once we realize, once all of us humans and all of us people, regardless of what culture we're from and regardless of what our religious persuasions are, political persuasions, and the color of our skin, once we realize that part of our makeup is spiritual, then we can finish our maturing process as human beings. Once we take care of that and tend to that part, we become a complete person. And when we become a complete person, then we can start to discover who we are and what our purpose is and why we've been put here, and we can fulfill that process.
That's Paul LaRush from the group Brulé. You can find them online at Brulé Records, spelled B-R-U-L-E. And that's it for this edition of The Modern West. Catch our next episode on the third Tuesday of the month. If you like what you hear, we'd love it if you leave a positive rating for us. In the meantime, you can find lots more stories about The Modern West at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Megan Kent produced this episode of the podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. The theme music is by Jeff Troxell, and I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Modern West is a production of Wyoming Public Media.